It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear from a man who, after years of working as a photojournalist, has decided to take photography down to its simplest form.
First, we're getting the latest news on the stock market. This morning, stocks took a big dive just a few seconds after the market opened, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping more than 1,000 points. Last week was the worst week for the stock market in 4 years. While the market has mostly bounced back as the day went on, current conditions are making investors nervous and raising questions about what's next for the markets and the economy as a whole.
Central Time economics correspondent Chris Farrell is here to break down the market news for us. He's a senior economics contributor at Marketplace and the author of Unretirement. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Chris, sometimes you got a wild day, week on the stock markets around the world, and it's the harbinger of doom. Something bad's coming. Sometimes we forget about it 2 weeks later. When we're in the midst of it, how do we know which is which?
Well, when you're in the midst of it, you start looking at the signs of panic. And what we had today really was a sign of panic, particularly as you mentioned, you know, with the Dow opening down over 1,000 points, and you had a huge decline, 8.5%, 8.6% in China. And it just, wherever you were looking, it didn't look like there was a safe haven. There was an article in Bloomberg Business that had that one of the few safe havens in the world was in Polish debt. This is one of the places people were going. So you knew this was a global contagion. It was hitting everything. But when you start separating out what's going on, we're going through a really turbulent period. The Standard & Poor's 500 is down about 12% from its peak in May. There are a lot of questions being raised about global growth, but this is not, with the information we have today, this is not a harbinger of doom.
Yeah, looking at the economy at large, not just the stock markets
right.
and what they're doing, how are we looking?
So you look at the housing market. The housing market continues to strengthen, and actually, the Midwest is now one of the strongest housing markets in the country. We still continue to have employment growth. When you start looking at all the sectors of our economy, you can't confuse what's going on in the stock market, what's going on in the economy. Still, a reasonable projection is that the U.S. economy is going to continue to grow at this 2% pace that it's been doing, and we're going to see private sector employment growth continue as it's been going. And what appears to be happening is, let's just very quickly, there's sort of like two or three parts of this story. Part of it is China. Okay, so how much is China really slowing down? You know, initially 3 weeks ago, a month ago, people like me were interested in what's going on in China. But, you know, it didn't have much of an effect on everybody else. But now there is a big question, how much is the Chinese economy slowing down? It has slowed down, and we've lost since China devalued its currency. World markets have lost about $5 trillion. This has now raised the other big question. What is the Federal Reserve going to do? The betting in the market, no question. The Federal Reserve was going to raise its benchmark interest rate in September, the first move since 2006. Now, the betting is the Fed's not going to do a thing.
So what, apart from the Chinese economy, are we that intertwined, or are there other factors leading to these drops in the U.S. stock market today?
Right. You know, what's happening with China should not have much of an impact on the U.S. So, I mean, we're intertwined, and the big impact of China on the U.S., when you're thinking about the stock market, is the companies that make up the Standard & Poor's 500. These are mostly global multinationals. And Asia has been a source of strength for their corporate profits. So corporate profits start coming out in 2 or 3 weeks. They're going to look good, I think. But that's going to be a snapshot of the past. Looking forward, corporate profits are going to be slightly weaker because of the problems in Asia. But really what China is influencing is a lot of the other emerging markets. You know, Malaysia, Indonesia, what's happening in Brazil. And so you're seeing a flight of capital away from the emerging markets. You're seeing a flight of capital away from the riskier sectors of the world economy, because, you know, a lot of people are going into emerging market debt. They get that higher interest rate. Now they're saying, oh, this is too risky. And we've seen a flight to safety, which is coming here in the U.S. So it is much more than just China. It's the effect that China's having on the other emerging markets.
Talking to Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor contributor at Marketplace, looking at today's and the last few weeks' stock market news. Big drop this morning on Wall Street, a rebound, another dip, and so on until close. Now, Chris, most of our listeners, I think, are not big wheeling Wall Street investors. Just a hunch. I don't have the numbers on that. But a lot of people do have maybe their own stock portfolio or retirement accounts more commonly. So as we're in this situation, what kind of things would you recommend people be thinking about if they're thinking about making changes?
Okay, you're absolutely right. For most individual Americans, most employees, most workers, the way they're exposed to the stock market and the bond market is through their retirement savings account. And you don't want to be doing anything when there's a global panic at this particular point in time. You know, let the big hedge funds and the institutions, the pension funds, you know, they're, as we saw, the market went way down, then it's kind of bounced back up. They're trying to figure out, okay, where is this going? We're going to have a lot of volatility. We have a lot of turbulence. But the fact of the matter is, unless you have some really pressing financial concern right here and today, what pays most of the time is just to be calm, don't make any actions, but learn from this particular moment in time. If you're hitting yourself on the side of the head saying, oh, I wish I knew I can't take this volatility. I knew I should have reduced my position in the stock market. Let's just say that's what you said. Remember that. And when the stock market's strong and everyone's saying about this is another great bull market, remember how you felt during this period of time and sell down to the sleeping point. So I would make my adjustments once we're past the panic, not at this particular point in time.
Now, some people might be thinking back to 2008 when stock market went down, and it was a prolonged Great Recession, we call it now. People were delaying their retirements because their retirement accounts went down. Should people worry about that now?
Well, you can't dismiss it. I mean, the stock market, Paul Samuelson, the late Nobel laureate, famously quipped that the stock market had forecasted, 17 out of the last four recessions. And, I think I slightly ruined that gave it too high a number. But that's the basic idea. No, right now I'm looking at the housing market, looking at the employment market. No, my sense is that the U.S. economy has a lot of strength and a lot of strength going ahead. The sad thing is that the U.S. economy right now is the strongest economy in the world. The emerging markets are going through problems. Europe, as we all know, is not growing very fast, and they've been dealing with all the problems with Greece. The U.S. is really a stellar economy, and we've all been hoping, in some form or fashion, we've been hoping that we're going to break out of this 2% growth rate, and we're going to go to something 2.5%, 3%. We're going to start seeing some real, economic growth. And I think what this tells us, we're going to keep growing around 2%.
What would it take to break out of that stagnation in some parts of the world, slow but steady growth here in the U.S.?
What it takes is, I think one of the lessons that we're going to take from this when we look back, and there's a big meeting of all the Federal Reserve experts are meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming later this week. One of the things, there's limits to monetary policy, and money is really cheap. There's a lot of money out there, and it's looking for good investment opportunities. And we tend to think about investment opportunities in the private sector, but there's also public sector investments, such as infrastructure, rebuilding ports and roads and bridges and railways and mass transit. And so, that is where I think this excess capital that is seeking some kind of investment opportunity, we should be doing a lot more public investment right now. And boy, if we're doing more public investment here in the U.S., I think that would improve our productivity, and it would also take advantage of these low interest rates to really make some long-form investments that we then get a rate of return over a considerable period of time.
I want to key in on one phrase you just used, excess capital. And we've been talking about this since the recovery started, the idea that banks are holding on to money, they're shy about taking risks with loans. Companies keeping some cash, they're being shy about investing in their capital, in labor. Is that still the case?
It's still the case. I mean, if you, particularly if you look at from the point of view of a global economy. So Ben Bernanke, the former Federal Reserve Board Chairman, Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, Paul Krugman, the Nobel Laureate, New York Times columnist, have been talking about that there just isn't the kind of investment opportunities that just attracts a lot of this capital, and particularly in the private sector right now. There's a lot of innovation going on in technology, but it doesn't take a whole lot of capital. And so this is why you have very low interest rates, and this is also why you end up with money going to areas like the emerging markets, you know, seeking that higher interest rate. But now all of a sudden people are going, maybe we took on a little bit too much risk. I'm going to get out of there now. I still think the story about this global savings glut is actually the right story to sort of take a step back and try to understand what's happening on a global basis.
A lot of it sounds like it's psychology, whether we're talking about the mood to invest that money or what happened today with the ups and downs of the stock market. What kind of psychological signals are you going to look for from investors as things open up on Tuesday and move ahead the rest of the week?
Well, what I'm going to really be watching for is just use the name Warren Buffett. Now, it may not be Warren Buffett, but Warren Buffett, the value investors. At what point do the value investor, I mean, remember, if you're looking at the U.S. stock market, it wasn't wildly overvalued, but by the historic levels, it was pretty highly valued. And so what I'm going to be watching is capital coming into the market and deciding that prices have fallen low enough and they can snap up some good companies at a reasonable price. And so that's what we're all going to be looking for. We're also going to be watching what does the Chinese Central Bank do. They have enormous resources. They have enormous reserves, U.S. dollar reserves. So what is the Chinese Central Bank going to do? We're also starting to see some signs of growth in Europe, some optimistic signs of growth. Okay, you have to be, you know, a little bit of a rose-colored lens, but there are optimistic signs of a little bit of a pickup in Europe. But mostly what I'm going to be watching is where are the value investors going and where are they placing their bets.
Chris, as always, I understand way more than I did 12 minutes ago. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor at Marketplace and the author of Unretirement. He's Central Times economics correspondent with us to talk about why the stock market has been fluctuating today and over the last week or so. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear from a guest who says changes are needed to make Wisconsin government more open and honest.
First, it's time for a Wisconsin Life. Cameron Gilley worked as a photojournalist for many years before he decided to take photography down to its simplest form, a pinhole camera. The simplicity of the camera has changed the way he sees and what it means to make a photo.
Pinholes have just been more of a gee whiz kind of look, you could take a picture with an oatmeal box. I was doing art fairs with digital nature photography and just wanted to try something different and to do something. I wanted to do something that nobody else was doing. And I toyed with the idea of pinhole for a few years, actually, before I actually took the plunge and tried it. I opened up the closet in my office and looked around and pulled out a cigar box that I had some stuff stored in. And dumped the cigar box out and made that into a camera. It's a box with film in the back and a pinhole of some kind in the other side of the box and a shutter in case this camera is just tape over the opening. There's no preview. It's really a lot of trial and error. You have to learn how to see without even a viewfinder. Its origins are the camera obscura. It dates way back to 1,000 years ago, that people learned that if you put a hole in a room, if there was a tiny pinhole in a dark room, it would project an image of what's outside on the back wall. For the most part, it was just kind of a scientific oddity, and medieval scientists studied it. That's how they learned about light, really, and that really is what led to photography, was that studying of light. The pinholes are, there's a very dreamy look to it. And I like it, it's soft too. They're not really that sharp. You know, when I was doing, I was a newspaper photographer, I was a wedding photographer, and then I did a lot of wildlife. So I was used to taking 3,000 photographs a day, and then going through and editing it down. And it's nice to now, a day of photography might be 3 pictures. And it's nice to really slow down and be very, just to be so much more deliberate about it. what digital has done to photography, I think, has made people believe that it's just a nice camera and it's Photoshop. It's a nice program or it's an app on your phone that makes a good photograph. Photography really boils down to just light and composition, and a pinhole camera does that. I mean, it's there's nothing else to it. Some people don't believe me. A common thing that people say is, well, you put a camera in there, right? It's like, no, this is the camera. This is it, what you're looking at. My favorite thing I ever heard anybody say was, this is about a 16-year-old girl that was in my booth here, and I was explaining it to her, and she looked at me and she said, well, how do you turn it on? I think for young people who have never seen film or taken a photograph on film, this is really mind-blowing to think that you can do this. And it brings up interesting conversations about the role of technology. Technology doesn't make you creative at all. And technology isn't a shortcut. It's just a tool. It's like anything is. It takes years and decades of experience to learn how to use a camera.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Well, Cameron Gilley is in the studio with us now with one of his pinhole cameras to tell us more about the experience of taking pictures this way. Cameron, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thank you.
Well, as you said in that piece there, you could take hundreds, thousands of pictures in a day with a digital camera or your phone, three a day with a pinhole camera maybe. So as you're setting up a picture, the new way versus this very old way, how do you think differently? What's going through your mind differently than if you were using a digital camera?
Well, the biggest difference is you don't see what you're getting. You have to pre-visualize it in your head. And so setting it up is totally in your head. Hmm. And it's a slower process. Sometimes your exposures can be 15 minutes. So you're more deliberate. You don't want to take 20 photos in a day because it just takes a lot of time. And also processing sheet film is a very slow process as well, one at a time usually. And so the most pictures I ever took in a day was 12, and I was up very late in the evening developing film and decided that was too much. So yeah, I like to slow down, and I think it really helps. You see, a good way to explain it, I had this friend who I would tell her about how I'd take thousands of photographs to get one good one for the paper. And then she said, well, why do you take all those other photos then? Why not just take the one good one? And it's kind of a really good point, actually. And so it's an exercise in thinking about what you're doing.
And so how do they turn out differently? You're taking those thousands of pictures or whatever for the news department, or you're also a wedding photographer. With this, you're taking maybe three or four in a day. Qualitatively, what's the difference if I'm looking at one or the other?
There's a different look to a pinhole photograph, definitely. It's really vignetted. It's kind of soft. It's a real dreamy look to it.
And what causes that?
It's just the design of the camera. Actually, a lens corrects those things, and without a lens, you have vignetting. It falls off towards the edges, and it depends on how you build the box too. The thinner the box, the wider angle it is. So, yeah, it's all in. There is actually a lot of control to it, actually.
And you build all your own pinhole cameras?
Most of them I have. Yeah, I do have some store-bought cameras. But I really like the really thin, really wide cameras. So those typically I've made. Yeah, most of them I've made, yes.
And you said you have no viewfinder, so you can't look through your little lens and take a snapshot. Say, so how do you know what you're shooting? Do you just have to shoot a panorama where anything is going to look like a nice shot?
Well, no, because you're developing the film one at a time. You don't want to take any more than you need to, really. So on my camera here,
Got a red box here.
Yeah, we can. I know this is radio, but I have a camera here. These lines that I have painted on the side, these are actually my viewfinder, I guess you'd say, or my sight lines.
I see. So you've got a triangle pointing to a peak here in the middle, and you're going to point at the arrow of the triangle, huh?
So if you sight down the one side, that's my left side and my right side, and then top and bottom, and then you put that together in your head, and you do sort of have a viewfinder.
So I think for radio work, cutting actual physical audio tape made me understand digital editing better. Do you think if someone worked with a pinhole camera for a while, they would become better photographers regardless of the technology?
Oh, absolutely, because you have to slow down and think about what you're doing, and you have to put it together in your head. You have to pre-visualize entirely. You don't have a preview. And I think that's something with digital photography is lost today. People who are what you call a digital native, who learned photography on a digital camera, they have an instant feedback all the time. And so film dinosaurs like me, it started in film and went digital and came back to film. I'm able to pre-visualize, and that's a good thing to be able to do.
Well, Cameron, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for coming in and showing us your cameras and talking about it today.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking to Cameron Gilley, freelance photographer in Madison. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll take a look at birthright citizenship, which has come up as a big part of the immigration debate among Republican presidential candidates.
First, an attempt earlier this summer to roll back the state's open government laws was met with a big show of support for transparency and openness in Wisconsin state government.
Our next guest says it's time to think of ways to make our open government laws sturdier and the business of governing more transparent and trustworthy. He's got some ideas to get the conversation going.
Mike McCabe joins us now. He's a president and founder of Blue Jean Nation. He recently wrote a blog post called 11 Steps to More Open and Honest Government. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mike, it's been a big political summer here in Wisconsin. Open government has been one of the hottest topics of debate, thanks to the budget provision on that topic. So bring us up to speed. How did we get to this point in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, Wisconsin used to be a leader in government transparency, and we were known from coast to coast as a state that was a beacon of clean and open and honest government. We've fallen on hard times when it comes to those kinds of laws. Those laws are under assault here, and it seems now we have a governor and legislators who are calling the shots at the state capitol who want to go in the opposite direction. They want to erode our open records law and other open government laws. They would like to, there are proposals to do away with the Legislative Audit Bureau, to change the composition of the Government Accountability Board and weaken that watchdog agency. Well, you know, I get that at the current moment we have people in charge at the Capitol who would like to weaken our open government laws, but they're not going to be in power forever. As citizens, we should be talking about how to go in the exact opposite direction that they seem to want to head. We should be talking about how to strengthen our open government laws, make them even better than they currently are, and move ourselves as a state toward a time when we can deserve that reputation for clean and open and honest government again.
There was that big pushback about the provision, which would have scaled back open and records laws in Wisconsin. So do you see this then as a good time to move forward with some of your plans here?
It's certainly a good time to talk about it. And you know, that it was heartening to see the public reaction when they tried to slip this thing in the budget to really cripple our open records law. That was an assault that I think took a lot of people by surprise, but it created such a strong reaction that in the end they had to back off. And for the time being, the open records law is safe, but I think it should actually be strengthened. I think there's a real need to modernize the open records law. It was written an awfully long time ago, and in some respects it hasn't kept pace with with the times. There's an awful lot that's changed that needs to be taken into account. So we should be talking about strengthening it rather than allowing the only debate to be whether we should do away with it or seriously weaken it.
Well, let's dig into your recommendations. And you start off with wanting to require all legislative proposals to have named sponsors. Now, initially in Wisconsin, this provision in the budget to roll it back did not have a named sponsor, and there's a lot of speculation. Where did it come from? You know, eventually we found out more, but is this a response directly to that?
Oh, it's a response to that and a whole bunch of other items that find their way into state budget bills. And there are legislative proposals that sometimes are toxic or sort of too hot to touch, and people don't want their names on them. But when those proposals find their way into state budget bills and have a chance of becoming law, we deserve to know as citizens who is putting these items forward. So, you know, I start with the simple proposal that any legislative proposal, any budget amendment, any proposal of any kind, any bill ought to have name sponsors.
Now, another on your list here is to strengthen open records laws by making it clear exactly how long government agencies have to process that request. It seems as though there's not necessarily consistency there. What do you think about the way we do it now, and what would you like to see done?
Wisconsin's law is pretty vague. It just says that government agencies are supposed to respond to public records requests as soon as practicable and without delay. Illinois, for example, says that agencies have 5 days to respond to an open records request. Maybe 5 days is not enough, but I actually cite an instance in the blog post where a Wisconsin newspaper was kept waiting for 352 days, close to a year before they got an answer on their open records request. That is definitely too long. So what I'm suggesting is that at least the open records law should be clarified so that it's more like the Illinois provision that says here's how long you have, and the clock starts ticking as soon as that records request is received by an agency.
Do you have a number in mind about what is, to use the term there, practicable for agencies?
Yeah, like I said, maybe 5 days is not enough, but a week or two, I think, is enough. And then if an agency has a darn good reason for taking more than a week or two, they should put that in writing, and they should respond to the requester. They shouldn't simply be able to ignore the request altogether.
It probably costs a bit of money to do things quickly. There may be sources in different formats and different places. It can be a tricky one, can't it, to try to gather material quickly?
Actually, if an open records request requires the compilation of a lot of data or a lot of records, regardless of whether it's done quickly or over a longer period of time, the expense is really going to be the same. But there shouldn't be an excuse allowed for just foot dragging. 352 days is ridiculous. I don't care how complex the request was. Keeping a newspaper waiting for almost a year is inexcusable, but it doesn't clearly say in the law that it's illegal in Wisconsin to keep a newspaper waiting that long.
We're talking with Mike McCabe right now, president and founder of Blue Jean Nation. He recently wrote a blog post called 11 Steps to More Open and Honest Government. And Mike, while we're on the subject of open records, Attorney General Brad Schimmel was on the show earlier this summer. Well, he came out against the proposed changes to the state's open government laws that we were talking about that were suggested in the budget. He did say there were certain parts of it that he understood, draft proposals being one of them. And the argument here is that lawmakers should be able to bounce ideas off each other, collaborate on legislation over email without worrying about having sort of a partially formed idea getting out there into the public as a matter of record. And Schimmel himself said he worries about this with his own work. And here's a clip from that interview.
Frankly, a lot of times we'll just avoid using email. And then I'll also have to go sit in my deputy attorney general's office and we'll have to talk through the issue, because I don't want the early versions of what we're discussing to become a public record, because, sometimes my initial reaction to things is doesn't look good. Sometimes that's why I have other attorneys on my staff to help straighten it out and say, oh, that plan doesn't work, Brad.
State Attorney General Brad Schimel there talking about why he understands that sometimes maybe drafting should not be considered part of open records. Maybe in the future making a move to make that an exemption or a partial exemption. What do you say to that? Does he have a point there?
I disagree. Public officials can sit around and talk with each other and kick around ideas and bounce ideas off each other. But once they actually have a proposal drafted, once it becomes a formal document, a draft, and they then take it and share it with colleagues, at that point, the public deserves to see it. And to be able to basically do the public's business, but under the cloak of darkness for what could be weeks or months, and then spring it all on the public at the last second and hold a hasty public hearing and then enact it all into law before people have had a chance to digest it. I have a big problem with that. And that's the kind of game playing that's being done at the Capitol now. The public is often given very little time to digest really complex proposals that have been exchanged and shared among legislators for what sometimes is quite a while. So my feeling is that if they want to sit around in an office and kick around ideas, fine. Once they start to put it in writing and they share it with colleagues, then it also should be shared with the public.
Now, this is not a perfect apples to apples analogy, but as a writer, people put things down there as first drafts that they would never want to see the light of day. And I imagine that there could be a corollary with the law there. You may have an idea, but certainly you would never want it to be taken seriously. So where do you draw the line there?
Well, if you're a legislator and you have something drafted, but you don't share it with colleagues, it's exempt under the open records law, and you don't have to share it. And again, you can be talking about the ideas and you can be talking about what you're driving at with a legislative proposal. But once you actually put it into draft form and you start to circulate it among fellow legislators, at that point, I think the public deserves to see it as well. And I think I think citizens are to be trusted with the fact that proposals evolve and that sometimes an initial draft of legislation has got flaws. That's exactly when the public should be engaged, so that citizens can point out that, hey, this wouldn't work, or this is flawed in this respect or that respect. That's exactly when public input is needed. And I think there's an understanding among people that a first draft isn't going to be what the final bill looks like, and that's okay.
We're talking to Mike McCabe right now of Blue Jean Nation. He says we need to strengthen Wisconsin's laws to encourage more open and honest government, and he's sharing his ideas.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the state's laws should be changed to encourage more openness and transparency in the way government does business? If so, what kind of changes would you like to see, and what kind of questions do you have for Mike McCabe? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a moment, but first, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Blue Jean Nation founder and president Mike McCabe. He says Wisconsin needs to make its open government law sturdier and the business of governing more transparent and trustworthy. And he's got some ideas that he thinks will help.
You can join in with your ideas, too, at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see change, if anything, here in Wisconsin when it comes to open government and transparency? And are these important issues to you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Before we go to the callers, let's talk about the Government Accountability Board. Now, some politicians are seeking some major changes that would fundamentally alter its status as a watchdog agency. What approach would you rather see taken in regards to the Government Accountability Board?
There's a lot of interest among lawmakers to get more control over the GAB, to have more appointment. Control over appointment to those who serve on the board. To me, that only would weaken it. That would only turn a watchdog into a lapdog. And I think instead, three things could be done to actually strengthen the Government Accountability Board. One would be to properly fund it. Over the last 5 years, we've actually seen the GAB's budget go down at a time when they were being asked to take on more and more duties. They were given less and less funding to do it. So that would be where I would start, is actually give them the resources they need to do their job. Secondly, the original law that created this agency, I think, had two major flaws. One was that there was a small part of that law that created a home court advantage for politicians. If politicians in Wisconsin are accused of criminal wrongdoing, they get to choose where they'll be tried. They'll get to choose what court they'll have their case heard in, and they can choose their home county if they wish. That's a privilege that no other person accused of wrongdoing in Wisconsin has. That should be done away with. And then finally, the law currently prohibits the Government Accountability Board from being public about complaints that are filed or investigations that have been undertaken. That also weakens the Government Accountability Board's ability to operate in a transparent fashion. That law should be changed so that complaints are public and the deliberations with respect to investigations by the board would be held in open session. That's something that could be done that would actually make it more apparent to the public what the Government Accountability Board is doing, how it's doing it, would I think overall strengthen the agency.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Cadott. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment that we do need that accountability. We need to have sunshine going into who's doing the drafting of the legislature. I do not agree that it's the same thing as writing a draft on a book or something like that. We're in a representative form of government. We elect our representatives to do these various tasks for us, and if we don't have the ability to see who it is that's pulling the strings and really, you know, making the case for a particular kind of legislation, whether it be for good or for ill, we have no way then to know how at the ballot box to perform. I mean, ultimately, it all comes down to is if I don't know who it is that's writing the bad stuff, I don't know who to throw out on their keister.
All right, Mike, appreciate your point of view there, and obviously you agree with that, Mike.
Yeah, as someone who grew up in his neck of the woods, all I can say is amen.
All right, well, appreciate that call there. And we're going to go next to Ellen joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think it's interesting that at this time in when they're asking for Hillary Clinton to be more transparent with all her dealings, that the Republican-controlled government Wisconsin is trying to do the opposite.
Ellen?
And I just think that your point that the one party that's in control is not always going to be in control is important to remember.
All right. Thank you for the call, Ellen. And we're not necessarily talking about Hillary's emails, but do you think that she has handled them the way an official should if she was moving toward transparency?
Both sides should be more transparent. I think Hillary should be more transparent about her emails, but certainly those who are in charge and calling the shots at our state capitol here in Wisconsin shouldn't criticize her with one breath and then turn around and say, hey, we've got to weaken all of our open government laws because they're annoying to us. Those laws are incredibly important protections for the public, and we need to fight for those protections.
And Mike, as a philosophy of government, can you make the case for us at Ground Zero why you think laws like this, sunshine laws, open government laws, are important?
Well, you know, as the caller from Cadott just said, if lawmakers are able to conduct the public's business out of the light of day, in under the cloak of darkness, we have no way of determining whether the decisions they're making are good. We have no way of meaningfully commenting or providing input. Look, to me, sunlight is always the best disinfectant, and the best protection against corruption in government is sunshine. It's making sure that the public's business is done fully in the public's view, and you know, and unless we want corruption to take even greater root than it already has in Wisconsin, we need to talk about strengthening these laws and not allowing them to be weakened.
Are there exceptions to that given our place in history right now, national security, for instance, should be taken into account as we look at things like this?
Well, our laws are written to allow issues like that to be taken into account. But I think almost always we should err on the side of openness and transparency. And the exceptions should be very rare, and they should be very limited. Whenever possible, the public should be clued into what's going on behind the scenes. And the impulse among so many politicians is to do the opposite. It's to try to do things behind closed doors, out of the public's view. And these are not matters of national security that are being discussed more often than not. They're legislative proposals that the public deserves to know about.
Let's go back to our callers now. Richard is with us next in Lime Ridge. Richard, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Okay. A few points I have been mulling over. They should do away with these overnight legislation sessions, especially when they are going to be voting on important issues at the last moment that may not even have been made public before. And they should have any bill that they're going to pass published 2 weeks at least before it will be voted on, so that the public can really be part of what's going on.
All right. Richard, appreciate your thoughts there. Mike, what do you say to those?
Terrific idea. You know, we've seen all too often proposals that are written up, and then they're sprung on the public, and people are given a matter of hours to digest really complex proposals, and then are supposed to come and testify at a public hearing and provide meaningful input. And those hearings are held hastily, and people are given limited time to comment. And then the legislature turns around and passes them. That's unforgivable. And I love his idea, you know, creating that kind of opportunity for people to see and digest proposals would be a huge step forward.
No, we were talking about Attorney General Schimmel earlier. He hosted an open government summit earlier this summer, and he was looking to modernize the state's open government laws, one of the hot topics there being a reflection of today's technology. And you say that we can strengthen open records law even more by clarifying that electronic records have to be treated like paper records when it comes to storage and retrieval. What else are you looking at there?
Well, you know, our open government laws were written in the early 1970s, and it was before the age of the internet. It was before so much communication by email, all of that. And our law doesn't explicitly address how electronic records should be handled. They need to be as open and accessible as paper records, and the law doesn't speak to that. So there's a great example of where our laws need to be brought up to date and modernized, so that it's clear that the public has as much right to see electronic records as paper records, because so much business is being done now in a solely electronic format where there isn't a paper document. So, you know, that's an incredibly important issue that needs to be addressed. And laws that were written in 1973 aren't suited to serve the public's interest in 2015, not with so much technological change.
Now, you're trying to start a conversation about all of this right now. Are you also hopeful that some of these ideas you have here could get some traction?
Oh, I think these ideas have traction among the general public, and now it's a matter of focusing a conversation and getting people to then put adequate pressure on elected officials to act. I put forward 11 ideas. I'm sure people could come up with 11 or 111 more. You know, people can check out the blog post and see what they like and see what they dislike, and then they should add to that. But we need to talk about how we can strengthen these laws. And these were 11 ways that we could go about trying to do that.
Mike, thanks a lot for coming in and talking today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Mike McKay, president and founder of Blue Jean Nation. He recently wrote a blog post called 11 Steps to More Open and Honest Government. We've been talking about those recommendations.